I met John Kelly on the street at a protest in D.C.
How you doing?
I was actually talking to an advocate at the time who had a sign he was holding up about marijuana saying, if you have a story, come and talk to me. And John Kelly came up to us and said he had a personal experience with police and marijuana.
I had police stop me one time, search my car saying they smelled marijuana, find the whole car.
Police had stopped him and searched his car saying that they smelled marijuana.
Put me in handcuffs while it was winter, it's January. Took my jacket off, searched my car. I sat outside in the cold for a good 20 to 15 minutes as they searched my car looking for marijuana, didn't find anything.
He had to sit outside for a while, and he said they found some seeds but never found any marijuana, and kept telling him that it smelled like marijuana and he had to have something in there.
Oh, it smells like you smoke in your car often and you must have weed here. They searched the whole car and didn't find anything.
They finally took him into a holding cell and then made him take drug classes.
I know so many of my friends who are Caucasians who've been stopped by police and just get a slap on the wrist and like, oh, put the weed in the street and step on it.
John's point was that he knows a lot of people who are white who maybe have had similar run-ins with the police and have just gotten off with a slap on the wrist.
And that doesn't happen to me. I've been choked, I've been pushed up against the wall, I've been handcuffed, all type of crazy stuff. It's just unfair.
The point that he makes is actually proven through data. The ACLU has done multiple studies on this over the years, and their findings have always been the same, which is that Black Americans are 4 times more likely than white Americans to be arrested for low-level or nonviolent marijuana crimes, like possession. But all the data, meanwhile, show that Black and white people use marijuana at essentially the same rate.
I get PTSD every time I see police walk behind me. I have friends like, oh, hey, officer. I feel like, hey, officer, what is it? How come I can't just say hi to you? It's crazy, bro. It's just crazy.
I'm Jeremy Siegel. This is Politico Dispatch. And today, Natalie Fertig on how decades of drug policies that target Black and brown communities have fueled the crisis in American policing unfolding today.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to summarize for you the meeting that I have just had with the bipartisan leaders, which began at 8 o'clock and was completed 2 hours later. I began the meeting by making this statement, which I think needs to be made to the nation. America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse.
To understand where we're at right now, you really have to understand this thing that's called the war on drugs. And people use this phrase a lot of times, but it was started by President Nixon.
In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive.
And then it was actually continued by both Presidents Reagan and Clinton.
We sought to be tough and smart, to punish criminals and to prevent crime. We put more police on the streets and taken criminals, guns, and drugs off the streets. Crime rates have dropped steadily for the last 5 years. Drug use has fallen by...
The long story short is that for each of these presidents, it was a political strategy. This reporter named Dan Baum, who wrote a book called Smoke and Mirrors about the war on drugs, interviewed Nixon's former aide, John Ehrlichman. He published this quote that has now become infamous in Harper's Magazine in 2016. You want to know what this is really all about? The Nixon campaign in 1968 and the Nixon White House after that had two enemies, the anti-war left and Black people. Do you understand what I'm saying? We knew we couldn't make it illegal to either be against the war or Black. But by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and Blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt those communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. You kind of have to look at the war on drugs through that lens.
How does that all trace to the more recent history of policing and race in the U.S. Why does it matter right now?
The most obvious thing is just the mass number of people who are arrested for things like minor possession of marijuana. But there's something deeper. That same ACLU study that I mentioned showed that states that have decriminalized marijuana definitely reduce the number of people who are arrested for marijuana possession and minor marijuana crimes. And then legalizing it actually reduces it, the numbers even more. And we're talking exponential reduction. This isn't a minor reduction. But what the ACLU study also showed is that it doesn't exponentially change the rate of arrests. In fact, in some states, Black people became more likely to be arrested than white people for the possession of marijuana. And one expert I spoke with, John Hudak of the Brookings Institution, said that this shows that the problem is deeper than just whether weed is legal or not. It's a problem with policing. In trying to kind of understand that, I talked to this former law enforcement officer from Torrance, California, named Kyle Kazan.
I was a police officer, but I did a lot of stuff in the war on drugs during that was one of my main focuses.
He's now the owner of a cannabis company in California, and he said that when he was a police officer, he spent a lot of time working on drug cases. And he told me that the military equipment that many police departments have, like tanks, we talk a lot about the militarization of police, a lot of that equipment was bought with money from drug seizures.
They gave awards out to officers for making big busts. The department gets money and they buy, you know, stuff from the military and they military up.
A lot of people don't realize that police departments can keep the cars and the cash and other seized assets from drug busts, and that they actually make that part of their operating budget. So that in itself incentivizes the police department to have a drug team and to make drug arrests.
So a lot of the policies that we saw during the war on drugs are still around and are still influencing the way police operate right now.
Yes, completely. Even, for example, a no-knock warrant. That is something that was created to not give a drug dealer the time to hide evidence of their crimes when police came to raid a drug house. But police were in possession of a no-knock warrant when they entered Breonna Taylor's home, and they killed her.
Breonna Taylor's family is suing three Louisville police officers after the 26-year-old woman was shot and killed in her apartment. Now, officials say this incident back in March was tied to a drug investigation where police were searching for someone else.
With Breonna Taylor's case, it wasn't even the right place, or it wasn't the right house, or there weren't actually drugs there, or if they'd knocked and entered, they wouldn't have found anything. So it's not just about the number of people who are arrested for marijuana possession, but the drug war has this widespread effect, this ripple effect throughout all of policing and a lot of the practices that are used in policing, and then also the funds that are used to support that policing.
What have you heard from demonstrators and activists on the ground about what sort of change they want to see on policing and drug policy?
A lot of people that I talk to feel like marijuana is an example of the bigger problem.
I think it's just another excuse to arrest us, like anything else. I mean, people are getting stopped for traffic lights and dying.
They say that legalizing marijuana itself would be good, but that it needs to be part of a larger plan. And they feel like the idea right now of legalizing marijuana often doesn't take them into account.
We're focusing directly on brown community right now because that's where we are getting the most unlawful arrests. That's where we're being detained for the dumb shit that everybody else gets off on. And it's very frustrating because at the end of the day,
I heard four or five different people bring up the fact that a lot of white people are now making millions of dollars for marijuana, and Black people are still often kept out of the industry or not given the resources to break into the industry. And that was something that I heard from a lot of people out on the street, was that just legalizing marijuana isn't enough. I mean, you have to change all of these deeper policing problems, but they also feel like if they're going to legalize marijuana, they need to give Black people an ability to actually benefit from that.
We've heard a lot over the past couple weeks about demilitarization, about defunding. Why do you think drug policy hasn't been as much a part of the conversation?
To be honest, that's something I'm trying to figure out myself. I mean, I can speculate, you know, it's a very complicated thing. And sometimes it's easier to just make a simple list of things. When you look at the list of things that, you know, say the bill that the House just put forward, it's a lot of the fastest, most obvious fixes. And some of the impacts of the war on drugs, like no-knock warrants, are on that list. But if you were going to dismantle the war on drugs, that would be an incredibly complex and complicated thing to do, because you're talking about private prisons, you're talking about a vast prison system, you're talking about the bail bond system, you're talking about the DEA and the fact that marijuana is still federally illegal. Heroin, crack cocaine, those are all also part of this drug war that has been leveled against minority communities. So it's not a simple fix, and it's not a fast fix. And maybe that's why. That is a speculation, though. I don't have a hard answer to that.
Natalie Fertig, thanks so much for talking with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Jeremy.
Also today.
Right now, I want justice for my brother, my big brother. That's Big Floyd. Everybody know who Big Floyd is now.
George Floyd, the Black man whose killing at the hands of Minneapolis police sparked nationwide protests over police brutality and racism, has been laid to rest. More than 500 mourners gathered at a church in Floyd's hometown of Houston on Tuesday. Friends, faith leaders, and family, including Floyd's brother Rodney, remembered him as a son, a brother, an uncle, and a father, and demanded justice.
Third Ward, CUNY Homes, that's where we was born at, but we're going to be remembered. Everybody going to remember him around the world. He's going to change the world.
Tuesday's funeral closes 6 days of mourning for Floyd in three cities. Among those in attendance were the families of other Black victims, including Trayvon Martin, Eric Garner, Pamela Turner, Michael Brown, and Ahmaud Arbery. And the World Health Organization is walking back claims made by a top official about people who've contracted coronavirus but don't show symptoms that sparked worldwide controversy and confusion. On Monday, epidemiologist Maria Van Kerkhove, the WHO's technical lead on the pandemic, said asymptomatic spread of the virus is, quote, very rare. The claim contradicted advice given by health experts and policymakers in most countries who have based calls for social distancing and other public health efforts like wearing masks on the idea that people without symptoms can unwittingly spread coronavirus. On Tuesday, Van Kerkhove said she had been misunderstood and her remarks were based on preliminary unpublished data, adding that the extent of asymptomatic spread is, quote, a big open question, though some disease modeling studies suggest it accounts for 40% of all infections. Public health experts have panned her decision to cite research that isn't publicly available and worry the confusion could undermine the WHO at a critical moment in the global coronavirus response. Subscribe to Politico Dispatch wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jeremy Siegel. Thanks for listening.